Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. Good to have you with us. We're about to meet Ruda Kwaramba. Ruda is National Director of World Vision in Uganda. She was the host of the Channel 4 program, which we screened on ABC television, I think towards the end of 2008, called Millionaire's Mission, in which a group of self-made millionaires, I think five of them, went off to Africa to see what they could do for a village in need of some support and a secure future. The results were, to say the least mixed. Well, Ruda headed up World Vision in Zimbabwe as a human rights lawyer. She's also worked for women's organisations as well as the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. Ruda Kwaramba is our guest in this hour, and let's introduce her with the music of the Soweto Gospel Choir, singing Jerusalem.
Jerusalem, Mikayalam, Ehi.
Ruda, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thank you.
Ruda, when you took a group of English entrepreneurs to Africa, did you have any idea of what turbulence you would cause both for them and the village upon which they descended?
I don't know, actually. We had an idea that there would be a clash in approach, a clash in seeing things. But I think that was part of what we were hoping would happen, just to give an idea to the world and to the general viewership of some of the differences in terms of how you do it in business and how you do it in development.
What was your aim? What was the aim of World Vision in taking a group of millionaires to a village in Africa? Was it to do something for the village or to do something for the millionaires?
I think it was to do something for the general public more than anything else, to get an understanding that development is not easy. And you must understand that for World Vision, it's not us who approach the millionaires. We're approached by a producer. And they were just taking to another level the whole reality TV story. And they were looking for an organization that was working in communities and was willing to partner with them to see if we could have some quick fixes to poverty through using some successful millionaires and their entrepreneurial approach. So we were willing to accommodate them because we knew, and at least we hoped, that it would take away the myth that some people often have that you can do development quickly, throw some money at it, and it will happen. So for World Vision, it was an opportunity to bring our ordinary viewers on a journey to understand that development is complex and it's not easy and it's about people, and because people are complex, it comes back to being complex itself. So that was our interest as World Vision. And by the way, I was still with World Vision UK then. Now I'm actually working in Uganda, still with World Vision, fortunately.
One of the interesting outcomes of the program was that, well, certainly the aim you had in mind was achieved. One of the interesting things I took away from the program was that ultimately entrepreneurs are very self-motivated and self-driven. One of the entrepreneurs ultimately couldn't work with the group and just said, look, I'll throw money at building a water pipeline and I'll get it done through hell or high water, even if it's not the right thing to do and the villagers don't want it, I'll do it. Another basically thought that this whole thing could be solved by PR. None of these approaches ultimately satisfied the long-term sustainability requirements of the program.
Well, I wouldn't say so. There was one very innovative idea, which is actually still ongoing, which had to do with setting up a hotel in a rural community. It would draw on the whole world of PR and kind of good, noble tourism and bring that together and generate some income for the village. And I would say to you that program is still running and is generating some money for the community. So that was very unique. And it was really about bringing together something that is entrepreneurial, but also that meets with a need that is felt and real in the community.
That is, it had to capture something of what the community's long-term aspirations were.
Yes, and also their capability to sustain something which didn't require a whole mindset shift on their part, something they could absorb and do alongside their everyday life, if you know what I mean.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia and via the web to the world. We're talking with Rudo Kwaramba, Director of Advocacy with World Vision, now working in Uganda. Rudo, let's talk broadly about yourself for a moment or two. Your background is one from the law. You come in through advocacy work. What caused you to associate with a group like World Vision? Why didn't you just basically go back into Zimbabwe or Uganda as a lawyer and work there on basic local issues?
I guess as a lawyer, I realized that you kind of take one case at a time. And that is a very slow process, and it was always dependent on the client having the money and their facts being linked to some legal maxim and you arguing it through. But the impact, even if it was very positive, would generally just have an impact on one person. Whereas development, you have the opportunity to multiply the impact as it were. So my faith, my Christian faith, and my desire to do good, I think caused me to be attracted to an organization like World Vision, and to see how what I'd learned in terms of getting hold of a principle, whether it's an international justice issue principle, and trying to apply it to whole communities could have a much more enhanced impact and long-term impact. So the commitment to justice is still there, but I think with development work, you can kill many, many birds with one stone.
I'd like to explore some of those in just a moment's time, but let's talk now about really the basic needs in Africa. We've had the financial crisis. We've had the impact that that is having, certainly at the Western world, but in developing countries, the global financial crisis has been even more deeply felt, and in ways which in some ways are harder to repair. Can you just give us some idea of the sorts of issues you're dealing with in Uganda?
Well, on the ground, we are dealing with issues to do everyday needs, water, health, education, and where the resources to support that kind of work comes from. And I guess when you have a global crisis, it affects the people who give towards development aid, and automatically it has a knock-on effect on some of the work that we are doing in Uganda through World Vision.
It also affects, of course, the very economies of the countries in which you are operating, so that they have less in their own economies to sustain their own development.
Yes, definitely. And the question very often, I think, where I work is not so much about the amounts of money in the kitty. It's how that money is distributed and some of those leakages, corruption, waste, theft, just things that kind of get in the way of countries being able to achieve their development objectives. And I think that is a big challenge, whether governments make the right policies and then apply the resources that they have in line with those priorities that are agreed on and that are likely to secure the well-being of children, marginalized communities. And I think that's an ongoing challenge in terms of development actors like World Vision.
I'd like to get back to the issue of transparency and corruption and those sorts of things in a few moments, but let's talk for a minute about the sorts of priorities you'd give. In the job you have, where do you see the most important priorities as lying? And not just, say, in a country like Uganda, but you're a Zimbabwean, you must see those same issues, the similar issues in Zimbabwe. For somebody in Australia looking at what needs to happen and what they can do, where are the priorities for you that people in other countries can have a real impact on?
I think the greatest priority from where I sit and from the work that I've done over the years is the issue of governance. How are decisions being made and who gets to influence those decisions? And I think it's important for people in Australia and in the world to understand that it's important for local people to be aware enough about their own context to come up with an idea of what their priorities are and have a way in which they can influence their policymakers to make decisions in line with those priorities. And I say it's important for everyone to know, because while we talk about corrupt governments, irresponsible governments in developing countries, there's also a level of corruption and irresponsibility globally, where local governments are pushed into making decisions that don't work for their citizens. So there are all those challenges. And then, of course, you go right down to the community, and it's basic things like clean water, food, education, health for children, mothers, and communities. And why I really prioritize governance is that it has a unique way in which it can interact and solve those very basic human needs if the right choices are made by policymakers.
Let's talk about an example of the sorts of things you've been involved in. You moved from private practice to spend a few years working in Zimbabwe with an NGO looking at gender violence. What specifically were the issues that caused you to move from private practice? Can you give us some examples of the sorts of things you were dealing with?
Well, I remember when I was in private practice, I remember representing a lady whose son wanted to sell basically what was her home. Now, how did he have the right to sell that house? Because prior to the independence in Zimbabwe, women could not own property. So when her husband died, her matrimonial home was transferred into the name of her son. And here she was aging, she was dependent, and her own son wanted to sell that house in which she was living. And I represented her and were able to get the house registered in her name, because post-independence, women could own property. So that's a very specific case. And I realized there and then that advocacy and getting the right policies in place has a much greater impact than taking one case at a time.
And it's this level of taking it from the local and applying it to the national that brings you face to face with the difficulties of institutional transparency. You've moved from one level to the other, or do you bounce between the two? Do you try and keep your feet on the ground as well as dealing with the policy stuff, the governance stuff?
Well, I kind of keep my feet on the ground via the system. World Vision in Uganda works at the community level. We hear the stories. I visit the field. I see the reality. And then I spend a lot of my time in Kampala, the capital city, and have opportunity to work with a team of people who knock on the doors of government, on the doors of cabinet committees, and we try and engage with them to make changes in certain policies, because we have seen on the ground the difference that it would make for children in those communities. So I don't spend my days every day dealing with individual issues affecting individual members of the family or children, but I get a bird's eye view, if you may call it, by sitting where I sit of what are the causes of infant deaths in Uganda. And I know today it is malaria, and an underlying cause is malnutrition. So what do we do? Maybe we engage with the Ugandan government to allocate more money towards education. So I do get an idea of what's happening locally, and then I get an opportunity to also talk to people who have the power to make a difference nationally.
On Sunday night, we're talking to Rudo Kwaramba, a director of advocacy for World Vision in Uganda, and somebody who's taken a broad interest in the field of aid and development internationally through World Vision. Rudo is in Australia to talk to the Surrender 10 conference a week or so ago, held in Melbourne. Rudo, let's talk about yourself for a moment and how you grew up and the opportunities you were given that you'd like to see provided for others, particularly other women. Being a woman lawyer presents, I guess, its own problems as you come up through a system that for many generations has had a culture where women do not occupy the same position as men. Was that part of what drove you into the law, that sense that you needed to establish yourself?
I was very fortunate that I grew up in an era where Zimbabwe was in a post-independence era. There was space being created for women, for men. There were very positive policies. So I kind of walked into a place where I felt there would be adequate room for me to excel, to speak out, and to be part of a respected profession that was making a difference in my country.
How important was your religious background in that?
Very key, very key. I think running through my heart, because of my faith, I really thought it was important to make a difference for people and wider than myself, but to also then be able to occupy a place where you could be heard and you could, I suppose, pay your own bills. And I had grown up on a mission station actually run by the Dutch Reformed Church, and I'd received what I would call maybe the best of both worlds. Basic services, a good education. I'm one of three kids, two brothers. My parents were professionals, my mom a teacher. My dad an educationist. So I knew that there was an expectation that I would go a step further than where my parents had been. And I wanted to be a person who would influence the future for my own country. At the same time, have an opportunity to serve other people through my own studying.
It's been a difficult transition process for the post-independence generation, both in Zimbabwe and in Uganda, with what happened afterwards. We're still living with the Mugabe situation in Zimbabwe. You had the Idi Amin period in Uganda. This must have been very difficult for young people trying to establish who they were in the world and where they took their position on issues like nationalism and independence, their loyalty to faith traditions which had their homes outside the country. Did you were part of that tension? Was it a tension for you? And is it, I guess?
Well, I guess for me, I tend to be generous with societies and how they develop. So looking back to the critical point, which for me was about the end of the 1990s and the beginning of the 2000s in Zimbabwe, the challenges there were about having had a liberator lead a country, and now the liberator needed to pass power and control to the people that he was instrumental in liberating. And I think that's where the challenge was. But what has happened was not unexpected, because I think countries go through processes. Democratization is not about installing governments. It's about changing the views of citizens and getting those citizens to engage with policymaking and government. And when one moves faster, it can stagnate, and then the people have to take charge. And I think what's happening in Zimbabwe is a process of people knowing that it's their duty to make decisions that will work for them, and that often takes a while. And I think the challenge the world has is it took a long time for democracies to evolve elsewhere, but in Africa we seem to expect them to happen overnight.
Yes, it's about institutional ownership, and the heart of institutional ownership is the rule of law. And that is a very abstract concept, a philosophical concept, which even in Western democracies, most people throughout their lives never even have to reflect on, because that they actually just accept it without actually understanding necessarily what it means. And it is a very sophisticated and very abstract concept.
Yes, and I would say so. And you see, for Zimbabwe, the point which we could have been very strategic is had we agreed to review, rewrite, reform our constitution in 2000, we would have averted some of the suffering that's going on in Zimbabwe now. Because rewriting a constitution engages a people in the making of a supreme law that will govern them. And in that process, you get to know that I'm a citizen. And because I'm a citizen, I have entitlements, and my government has duties, and I can say to them what it is that I would like them to observe in relation to my life. And you see, that would have happened, but we missed the opportunity.
The rule of law also takes you beyond another concept which is integral and actually necessary to life at a subsistence or village level. That is the notion of barter and personal relationship, because the rule of law necessitates you divorce yourself from personal relationship. This is an extraordinary leap.
Well, I guess so. And that's why it's important that there be processes that help people to make that leap from what happens to me personally and individually, and how I can also influence the corporate and the bigger picture.
Do you find that you were ever caused to reflect philosophically on this stuff as part of your job? I mean, it seems to me you're dealing with several things at a quite sophisticated level at one instant and a basic level at another. And this must involve both theological and philosophical and legal reflection.
I think all the time. We always do. But we need to make sure that we talk about where we have expertise. In coming up with our strategies as World Vision, we look at a national program and we say, where do we have strengths and where do we need to build strengths and where do we need to build linkages and work in coalitions and in networks. And when you can do that, you don't have to have the in-house skills to operate at reviewing policies and laws all the time. You do, however, need to appreciate that even though you're working at a community or village level and your interest is the child, you need to make the linkage in terms of what do I need to do to make sure that at a national level, the right policies are in place for that child. So you don't always do it yourself and you don't do it in the same way. You could have a program yourself that you fund and support, but then in another realm, you enter into networks and relationships with other agencies so that you can push for the right policy.
The other area that you did allude to in this policy arena is transparency and governance as a major concern. It's not just transparency and governance when you're dealing with state institutions. It has to do with the very organisations, the NGOs, that you're a part of. Often it's said that, oh, look, you know, we shouldn't give stuff to bilateral arrangements through the states. We should just go direct through NGOs. But NGOs are as vulnerable to the issues of personal linkages and alliances and potential corruption as state agencies are.
Yes, and you do need to be aware that the institution, its capacity to do work in a transparent way always needs to be reviewed. So you want to put in place a system of making sure that you are managing your people well, you're managing resources well, you're managing relationships well. So even in your annual strategy, you must have some what you'd call ministry objectives. What are you going to do in relation to the children in Village X? But you also need some objectives about what you're going to do about the systems in your organization, about who you hire, how you hire them, how you pay them and reward them, how you make sure that you are safeguarding the resources that are entrusted to you by people who have a clear objective of making sure the money gets down to the child in the field. So working and strengthening organizational systems is just as important as being clear on what needs to be done in the communities which we serve.
You can't just do this by yourself. I mean, World Vision can't do it as a standalone agency. Do you make linkages with other agencies also concerned? I mean, you have an international organisation of jurists called Transparency International, for example, that does offer help and assistance. Do you find alliances with other agencies on these benchmarking standards can help build coalitions of that are concerned with the same sorts of ethical values?
Oh, definitely. World Vision is a signatory to a number of codes of practice, and we have to make a report in terms of how we are doing to actually live out some of those codes and standards, sphere standards, the Red Cross Code of Conduct, One World. We work with them to make sure that we can be held accountable to the things that we promise we're going to do.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. Our guest is Ruda Kwaramba, director for World Vision in Uganda and previously in Zimbabwe, but also spent some time in London as an international advocate for human rights and particularly on women's issues. Ruda, the church and activism, it's something we touch on Sunday night quite regularly, and the Surrender Conference that you've been part of while you're visiting Australia has been concerned to say to evangelicals that Christianity is not just about, your religion is not just about what you do in private, that it does have a connection to the public sphere. How important is this for you, and how did you come to arrive at this view?
Well, I think I'm surprised that as a church worldwide, we've missed this or ignored it. Maybe it's because it's hard work. I think when you go to a discussion between Jesus, which is recorded in the Bible, he's asked, what is the most important commandment in the Bible? And he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And the second one, which is as important, is love your neighbor as yourself. So in terms of the principles of our faith, it has always been clear that our relationship needs to be upward with God and sideways with our neighbor. And so for me, I think I've always been subtly aware that how I live needs to reflect that I am committed to making sure that my relationship with God is reflected in how I relate to my fellow human being. Of course, I haven't always succeeded, and that's the tension.
And it can be a very complex process. Many people would caution against such world-transforming objectives from the very struggle that many of the African countries went through for independence, when they say, well, look, the churches allied themselves with the wrong forces, albeit the Dutch Reformed in South Africa with the white apartheid state, or even some churches and church leaders in Zimbabwe who've allied themselves too closely with Robert Mugabe.
Yes, and that is always interesting. But, you know, one thing that I find liberating is to be aware that the church worldwide is made up of human beings. And in the midst of good that is intended, you always mix up with the evil that is in all of us in different measures, of course. And it's interesting you mentioned the Dutch Reformed Church, because I grew up through the Dutch Reformed Church. So I was able to see people who were anxiously translating the Bible into our local language so that we would have an understanding of the word in our language. They were in the Dutch Reformed Church. Then you'd see some who were overtly racist and would use the word of God wherever they found them. Passages to support them in a sense of supremacy, a white supremacy. So I've seen good and bad in the church, but I've been open and liberated to pick out the good that I need to emulate and become the good and the change I want to see. As I think it's Dave Andrews, a writer and a theologian here in Australia, will talk about, and he talked about that during the Surrender Conference, the need to learn to be the change we want to see and not spend time pointing fingers at the past, the present, and the things that have gone wrong.
One does learn lessons, as you've indicated, from the experience, say, in South Africa, that you need not just the evidence of your tradition. You need something that is a lodestone which goes back initially to your understanding of what Jesus was all about. What for you essentially was that message then all about?
Oh, basically, he was saying he comes to us in love, and that love is able to cover over a multitude of wrong. But when he is loving, he is hoping that we would be attracted to his way of living, and his love would radiate through us to our fellow human beings, and in that way would become one.
That can be read as an optimistic message, and it is by many. It can also be read as a pessimistic message. That is, look, the human being is so fraught by flaws that really you need to sort of give up on this world-transforming stuff and just get your own personal convictions right, and then you'll go to heaven. That clearly is not the way you read it.
No, because I think it's about going to heaven, but it's also about bringing the kingdom of God on earth while we are on earth. Because wherever we are, and we are becoming more loving, more caring, more gracious one to another, we have the potential to make a difference. And I think if we give up, we are claiming a level of disempowerment, which is not necessarily true, nor is it desirable. We have to assume that we have the power to make a difference, starting with our own lives.
What sorts of messages are you bringing to young people? What are you saying to them at conferences like the one you've been to in Melbourne, or, for example, the Greenbelt conference, which is a huge conference which takes place in England every year? What's the essence of the message that you want to communicate?
I believe my message would be that you have a responsibility, at least to determine how you're going to live, but be aware how you impact on others. And if you make a decision to do that which is honorable, that which is positive, then you do need to tap into the power of God and Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit to give you that everyday energy to do that which is right. And also the challenge is, our world is made up of information that does not necessarily point us to this positive way of living. So if you'd like to go in that direction, make a point of acquiring the knowledge. And in my perspective, biblical knowledge, writings that are done by people who have faith. And do be positive. Don't give up on the world. There's a fair measure of what we know. There's a fair measure of what we don't know. And what we don't know, we need to mix it with faith that it's possible to create a better world, and you can be part of that. So it's a level of revolutionary thinking that starts with self and then can permeate those around us and the world we live in.
Ruda, we're almost out of time. You've given us a very optimistic message, yet you've come out of a continental experience which would cause one to be pretty pessimistic about mankind's capacity for redemption and transformation. You still see the possibilities for your own country and for other countries in the African continent, notwithstanding the way the world has treated them.
Yes, I do. And it's particularly because actually this week at Surrender, we had one of the speakers talk about Plan B. And Plan B focuses on actually even the world leaders who today we kind of would like to throw into the bin and write off. They would like to self-perpetuate, and they will self-perpetuate by answering to the demands we increasingly make on them. So if we transform how we live and we transform the views of people around us, we can and we have the power to transform even world systems that have not worked in the past.
Ruda Kwaramba, thanks for joining us on Sunday night.
Thank you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.